Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a career prosecutor from the Savannah, Georgia area. We are getting toward the end of our series on the murders of J.R. and Mary Crocker, with a look at the elected district attorney's role in taking the decisions on this case away from the citizens of Effingham County. Does that sound super nefarious and dramatic? Isn't it the DA's job to exercise discretion on cases brought to the office? Yes, it is. But the citizens of any given county expect their elected officials, particularly their district attorney, to make decisions on cases based on the facts and the law. Of course, these are also expectations citizens have of their judges. And as you heard in the last episode, the judges of the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit spent almost 7 years avoiding making decisions on the highest profile case in the circuit. How did the DA's role factor into that? It is not as straightforward as it may seem. And yes, I recognize that the last episode was very legal and technical. Capital litigation and the DA's role in it is legal and technical as well. But it is also impossible to understand the failures of the DA's office in the prosecution of this case without understanding what should have been happening. As we've already mentioned, back in December 2018, when the murders of these two children were discovered, the elected district attorney for the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit was Richard Mallard. Richard had been the DA since 2002. Like Sheriff McDuffie, Richard had presided over a lot of change over the years, and not just in Effingham County. For perspective, the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit consists of four counties: Bullock, Effingham, Screven, and Jenkins. Of these counties, Bullock County has always been the largest in population and having the greatest percentage of crime in the circuit. Screven and Jenkins County to this day are smaller and more rural, although neither county has a separate state court. So by Georgia law, the district attorney of the circuit is required to handle misdemeanors like DUIs and speeding charges on top of the usual felony caseload in those counties. But Effingham County, as you have heard, had been growing exponentially. Yet the prosecutorial infrastructure had not changed with the times. Truthfully, it seemed like Richard Mallard was unaware of how much things had changed in Effingham County. By the time Matt Breeden arrived in 2021, no one seemed to have any numbers to present at county budget meetings to justify any increase in the office's budget or in its staff. To clarify, in a circuit like the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit, the DA gets some state money to prosecute the circuit's cases. But each county chips in money for things like the mileage required to drive to their courthouse, office space, or additional staff like assistant district attorneys. By 2021, the Effingham County case numbers amounted to almost a third of the cases pending in the circuit. Yet for 10 years or so, the office had only one assistant DA consistently assigned to the Effingham office, while seven or eight were assigned to the rest of the circuit, primarily the Bullock office. That lonely, overworked assistant DA was Brian Deal. To be fair, Brian did have some help that was supposed to be regularly assigned to Effingham County, but those assigned to that spot never seemed to last long because serious cases were pushed to trial more frequently in Bullock County, so people were commandeered to Bullock pretty regularly. Brian had to fend for himself. Why does this matter, you may wonder? Doesn't the elected DA make all the calls for the office on a death penalty case? Not really. Because when a murder case comes into the office, it is not always clear up front whether any statutory aggravating circumstances that legally authorize the death penalty will be in play, or how strong the overall evidence for the evidence of those statutory aggravators will be. You see, in Georgia, for a case to warrant the death penalty, the state must not only prove to a jury the guilt of the accused beyond a reasonable doubt, but also, in a procedure unique to the death penalty, in the penalty phase, the state must prove to a jury those statutory aggravating circumstances beyond a reasonable doubt and convince all 12 members of the jury that death is the appropriate punishment, with life without parole or life as alternatives. For context, the statutory aggravating circumstances by law are generally these, and I'm summarizing. One, the murder, and I'm saying murder because despite the fact that the Georgia statute indicates that rape, armed robbery, and kidnapping are also treason and hijacking and some other things are also capital felonies. If a death does not occur, the state cannot seek the death penalty in those kind of cases. So the aggravators are these. Number one, the murder is committed by a defendant with a prior conviction for a capital felony. And I've set out some of those, but they have to have a conviction for that felony. Two, it's committed while the defendant is engaged in another capital felony, like that murder, raid, or kidnapping, or armed robbery, or things that aren't capital felonies, aggravated battery, burglary, or arson. Number three, the defendant, by his action, creates a great risk of death to more than one person in a public place by means of a weapon normally hazardous to more than one person. Four, the defendant committed murder in exchange for the purpose of receiving money or something of monetary value. Five, the victim is a judicial officer, district attorney, or solicitor, and the murder occurred because of that victim's official duties. Six, the defendant caused or directed another to commit murder or committed murder as an agent or employee of another. Seven, the crime was outrageous or wantonly vile, horrible, or inhuman, and that it involved torture, depravity of mind, or an aggravated battery to the victim. Eight, it is the murder of a peace officer, corrections employee, firefighter, any of those individuals is in performance of their official duties. Nine, the defendant is in or has escaped from lawful custody at the time of the murder. 10, murders for the purpose of avoiding, interfering with, or preventing the lawful arrest of the defendant or another. 11, the defendant is previously convicted of rape, aggravated sodomy, aggravated child molestation, or aggravated sexual battery. Or 12, murder was committed during an act of domestic terrorism. You may be thinking, wow, lots of murders fit that bill. And that's true. But given the intense scrutiny of these cases, it has long been the mindset of the prosecutorial community that you don't seek the death penalty unless the evidence of guilt is overwhelming and unlikely to change over time. In other words, it doesn't rely solely on an eyewitness who may change their tune. And also that you have that strength of evidence as to at least two statutory aggravating circumstances. For instance, the public's idea of what constitutes torture can change over time. So that evidence has to hold up over time. This is why the decision to seek the death penalty rests with the elected district attorney for each circuit. These cases take time and dedication. We'll talk more about whether the death penalty cases cost more as we go along, but the biggest factor in the decision to seek the death penalty is the strength of the evidence, which was the first major area where Brian Deal was influencing the decision. Prosecutors are often consulted about legal issues and other matters that affect investigations. As previously mentioned, Sheriff McDuffie and Captain Daly knew this case had the makings of a death penalty case within the first few hours of the investigation. Brian and the DA's office investigators were called in that night, and the DA investigators even interviewed Elwin Crocker, as you've heard. Brian was boots on the ground with this, and his understanding of the evidence as it was coming in was conveyed to the elected DA, Richard Mallard. Don't forget, though, that Brian had a job to do. Brian Deal, as a prosecutor, could best be described as solid, nose to the grindstone, a quiet, unassuming, mild-mannered guy. Brian was the kind of guy that didn't say much and certainly wasn't one to complain. The sole prosecutor in the Effingham office with any institutional knowledge of the county or its agencies, Brian had to handle all cases in front of three judges for long periods of time, think months to years, by himself. I've already mentioned that this circuit was rapidly growing in population. By the time I arrived in 2022, the pending caseload by judge in the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit was the highest in the state of Georgia, and the legislature approved a fourth judge to ride the circuit. Each of the judges had their own, often conflicting, methods of handling their caseloads. Rarely was the DA consulted about conflicts in the prosecutor's time. As far as the judges were concerned, if they had a docket, the DA or one of his assistants had to appear and move the cases, sometimes running between courtrooms or even counties, and make decisions on cases based solely on what they knew about the case in the moment. Putting fingers in dikes was basically Richard Mallard's management style, and even with that, Brian Deal was the only thing standing between the citizens of Effingham County and a flood of possible dismissals for want of prosecution. Not only did Brian have limited attorneys to help him, his administrative staff, to help him get hundreds of cases ready for these chaotic court dates, consisted of two administrative assistants, one that worked and one that didn't. Despite the Georgia Constitution protecting crime victims' rights to notice of court dates and an opportunity to be heard at any hearing where a defendant might be released, sentenced or have their case dismissed, no victim witness advocate was assigned to the Effingham office, and there were only two in the office at all. So Brian was expected to know everything about these cases, legally and factually, and basically try to get witnesses and victims to court on his own or with the help of his investigators, who, thank goodness, were excellent. This left little time for true legal advocacy on most cases, though. Motions practice, like filing notice to seek recidivist punishment or to introduce prior acts of child molestation, often just didn't get done. Which is not to say Brian was incapable of excellent legal work. He had beautifully handled motions on a defendant who had brutally attacked a sheriff's deputy, where the defendant was claiming insanity. He just rarely had time to do that kind of work, except in the most serious of cases. Cases that were less serious, or in which a victim like J.R. Crocker was said to be uninterested in prosecution, brought out the office's go-to move, putting cases on the debt docket. For those unfamiliar with the term, the debt docket is basically a list of cases that are still open, but are not being put down for the court's active docket for hearings or trials anymore. In Chatham County, the debt docket was used almost exclusively for cases where the defendant had skipped bond, so that that case could be reactivated if the defendant got arrested for his contempt of court. Not so for cases like Mark Wright's beating of J.R. in the Okeechee Judicial Circuit. That was dead docketed on condition that Mark Wright, quote, not commit any crimes. And yes, in the Okeechee Judicial Circuit, by the time I got there, there were defendants who had had multiple cases dead docketed, one after another, because no one had bothered to check their pending cases. It's pretty clear that the understaffing of the office meant no one had time to look at anything but the big cases, and you would think the Crocker case would be as big as it comes. As you know, the evidence was death penalty level in this case, too, though neither Brian Deal nor Richard Mallard were the kinds of guys to wait on actual written reports to make decisions. So while the case file was still incomplete and based primarily on discussions with investigators, the five Crocker defendants got indicted for these murders. All five were indicted as defendants together on March the 8th of 2019 to comply with Georgia's 90-day rule. Just so you know, the 90-day rule is one where if a defendant is not indicted within 90 days, they're entitled to a bond. The indictments were for felony murder, two counts, one for each child, cruelty of children in the first degree, two counts, one for each child, and concealing the death of another, two counts, one for each child. These were not death penalty cases yet. Legal notice had not been filed of the state's intention to seek the death penalty. But the charging decision on its face seems bizarre, doesn't it? Not malice murder. In other words, felony murder is not killing with intent to kill. And we know that these children were killed with the intent to kill them. And we know that in part because of Elwin's express intention in the text messages to finish Mary off, or Mark and Roy's searches for sodium pentothal or the yellow pill of death. No aggravated battery charges, despite the picture of Mary's torn up face, back, and buttocks. Did the prosecutors not know about the concrete evidence? Hard to say. But Roy Prater entered a plea to this indictment on condition that he testify truthfully with sentencing withheld. And Roy gave detailed statements, as you know. There were, of course, legal complexities to any potential trial of this case. The admissibility of the co-conspirator statements, in other words, the other defendants' statements, was well-settled law. But in this case, it only applied to the statements made to cover up their crimes or made during the pendency of the conspiracy. For instance, Alwyn's description of Kim shoving a ginger root into Mary would only be admissible against Alwyn, not against Kim, Mark, or Candace. But Roy's testimony now would be evidence that could be used and could be corroborated, as you well know. There were lots of nuances like that in this case, but it took another 7 months for the remaining cases to be reindicted and for the death penalty to be sought. In October 2019, new indictments were returned as to each of the remaining four defendants separately. Each was charged with malice murder, felony murder, aggravated sexual battery, cruelty to a child in the first degree, concealing the death of another, and false imprisonment. Mark was only charged with crimes involving Mary's death and concealing JR's death. But notice of intent to seek the death penalty, which sets out the statutory aggravating circumstances the state intends to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, was filed in each case on December the 4th of 2019. The statutory aggravators alleged included an allegation of the crimes being committed during an aggravated sexual battery of Mary. which is not lawful, though an aggravated battery, as the statute reads, was easily proven. The other statutory aggravating circumstance was that both murders, both the murder of Mary and the murder of J.R., were outrageously and wantonly vile and involved torture and depravity of mind. That's readily apparent, isn't it? Richard Mallard had signed all of these notices, but he had only one more year until he was going to retire. So why so little movement in the first year of this case? Hard to say. It may have been knowledge on the part of the DA that the FBI testing and forensic anthropology on JR was incomplete. It could be that they knew they were going to seek the death penalty, but were hoping for one more co-defendant to flip. Most likely, apathy, both on the part of the DA, who knew he wouldn't be around to complete a death penalty trial, and on the part of Judge Peed, who had the highest backlog of cases of all the judges in Effingham County. Was this because all of the judges and DA Mallard lived in Bullock County and Effingham County was a 50-minute drive away, just one direction? Whatever the reason, the case languished as the Capitol defenders came on board and COVID hit. I was incorrect, by the way, about Candace entering an early plea in this case. She did not plead guilty until October of 2020, and it is certainly a question why the DA's office would be willing to negotiate with Candace, given how culpable she was in both of these children's deaths. But honestly, most of what we know about Candace's culpability comes from Candace's proffer in exchange for her plea. Given that Mark had continually denied having contact with JR after his arrest, it was unlikely he would ever be forthcoming about what happened to JR or to Mary. And aside from Elwin, Kim might be the most evil person I've ever been in a room with. No one would actually want to negotiate a plea with her, and neither of them would be a good choice for negotiating a plea. Maybe the DA's office was concerned that Roy Prater was in poor health. He had been since before his arrest, so they wanted to be sure to have a co-conspirator witness that would be around for trial. A deal was struck. Candace pled guilty, received a life without parole sentence in exchange for truthful testimony, and Richard Mallard retired. Enter Daphne Totten. Daphne ran unopposed for the top DA spot in 2020 and was considered a great fit for the position since she had been a prosecutor in the office for 17 years and had served as Richard Mallard's chief assistant for a fair bit of that time. Daphne saw it as her mission to use federal grant money to get rid of the ballooning backlog of cases in the Okeechobee Judicial Circuit and to get Brian Deal some long-term help. To that end, she hired Matt Breeden in January of 2021. Matt, who had been the chief assistant in a multi-county district attorney's office before coming to Chatham County, and had quickly spotted the problems with how the Okeechobee Judicial Circuit office was organized. But as a new guy, he had to tread lightly. Matt also had to tread lightly with the Crocker case. A talented prosecutor of complex homicides, Matt, like everyone in our area, had heard about the Crocker murders and knew that this was a death penalty case. But this case was mostly Brian Deal's case, and Brian had a great reputation in that circuit. Early on, though, it was obvious that Brian was getting overwhelmed by the volume of work the Capitol defenders were throwing at him. It is their MO, as we discussed in the last episode, but it was an MO that Matt knew how to combat. Matt offered to help Brian with the case, because despite the multitude of motions filed, Brian had not filed a single response to any of them. Brian also didn't know what resources and brief banks could be available to help him out. How could he? Even at this point, he was literally 12 to 18 hours in the office every day, including on weekends, just trying to plead or dead docket cases he knew very little about. Brian accepted the help, but it soon became obvious to Brian, as it would to everyone in the Okeechobee Judicial Circuit, that Matt just operated on a different level. The old finger in the dike method of addressing problems was not the Breeden way. Brian recognized that help was being offered, though, and accepted it. There was some optimism with Daphne's regime early on as well. She used grant money to hire more staff and tried to get the judges on board with more uniform and logical scheduling of cases that would allow for prosecutors to actually learn the case file and contact the victims before arbitrarily disposing of the cases. But the old ways can be hard to change, especially if no one on the side of the prosecution had ever pushed any legal issues with the bench. Let's face it, legal issues like giving all parties a timely trial needed to be pushed on the Crocker cases, and it became obvious that Matt was up to the task, which intimidated Brian on many levels. Of course, the Crocker case still was languishing in relative obscurity as the office focused on getting rid of the backlog ostensibly created by the COVID pandemic. It wasn't created by that, by the way. But that is why I got hired in January of 2022. That was a COVID hire, originally intended to identify and dispose of the oldest cases in the circuit, which did not include the Crocker case. I was told I would only be working in the Effingham office, an hour drive each way for me. I had no intention of working in Bullitt County, which would be an hour and a half drive each way. But imagine my surprise when I arrived at the office and within days was told that I was expected to spend 2 to 3 days per week in Bullitt County. And, oh yeah, help try some of the most serious violent felonies up there, too. But I thought I was supposed to be clearing a backlog in Effingham. No one could tell me which cases were mine, but my name would randomly be assigned to something without notice, and I would find out after the fact that I had had court on a given day. For someone who believes in being prepared, the omens were not good. Rather suddenly, things got worse in April of 2022. Without getting into too much detail, Brian Deal had a health crisis in the middle of jury selection on that case I had mentioned before, the one where the officer had been attacked by the guy who was claiming insanity. This crisis eventually led to Brian retiring from the office, and the rest of us, now three ex-Chatham prosecutors, were to step in and divide Brian's caseload. So I was asked to help out with the Crocker case. The first Crocker motions I attended were scheduled on Elwin in July of 2022. Judge Pede had put down a set number of the motions for hearings, and it was clear that he, like other judges I had seen, was letting the capital defenders set the pace for how this case would proceed, reading motions verbatim on the least relevant topics or on areas of the law that were well settled against them. Daphne was present for some of the motion hearings, more so than her successor, but she was often distracted by trying to manage the office from her phone or laptop. And since Matt obviously had these boilerplate motions in hand, she would not stay for the entirety of the hearings. I could see from the file and the tone of the hearings that the capital defenders were going to keep claiming that they had not received complete discovery. This is an easy ploy wherever there's a change in lawyers on either side. If the new lawyer is the prosecutor, they may not know what has already been done. If the new lawyer is a capital defender, they have not looked at the file and want the court to make the prosecutors tell them what is in the file. To fix this, Matt and I met with the detectives, gathered everything they had, and I personally scanned in to an external hard drive everything they provided. It took days, and of course, they wouldn't come to pick up their copies. When we got into August 2022, I realized that my aging parents' health issues were going to require me to be more directly involved in their care. I discussed moving to part-time work with Daphne, including work from home, but I wanted to stay on the Crocker case if possible, which meant that Matt was not only doing the heavy lifting for the Effingham office, but pushing the Crocker case was all on him. Yes, I was still coming to court hearings when they were scheduled, doing legal research, drafting, and filing briefs as needed, but in reality, the case had stalled again. Daphne and I attended a capital litigation conference in January of 2023, and I was reminded that we were missing a number of categories of evidence that we were told could be critical for both the guilt-innocence phase of a trial and the sentencing phase. I emailed a list of what we would need to the DA's office investigator in Effingham County, who is now Andre Wright. What happened to Eric Reiner and Thomas Ron, you ask? Well, I mentioned that Investigator Reiner retired early on in this case. Thomas stayed with the DA's office until he, like Abby Brown, got offered more money by a local law enforcement agency. Around the time I started in the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit, Andre started as the Effingham office's investigator. The difference was that I had 25 years of prosecutorial experience on serious violent felonies under my belt, while Andre was still green as any kind of investigator, but you could not tell that by his ego. Andre did not take direction well. When asked to do a recorded interview with a domestic violence victim, I discovered that he was yelling at her and threatening to arrest her. I tried to talk to Andre about appropriate treatment of crime victims, but he felt the need to try to correct me by explaining that he knew all about domestic violence because he had had run-ins with his wife that had gotten physical before, and some things just didn't need to be prosecuted. Over the course of my first summer with the office, Andre tried to take it upon himself to, quote, organize the office, acting like the attorneys in the office had to answer to him rather than the other way around as required by law. I was working from home by 2023, and I emailed the list of the needed items to Andre. Weeks later, I was in the office and asked him about it on my way out to go home. I was in something of a rush, but Andre said something about getting an ex parte order for Elwin Crocker's medical records. I told him, no, you need a search warrant, but Andre wanted to argue about it. I didn't have patience for this, and I told him I was pretty sure that his claim that that's how we always did it at the sheriff's office didn't make it legally correct, and that if he had a question about the search warrants, he could talk to Matt. He didn't. Unbeknownst to me, he took an ex parte order to Judge Pede and got the records. I would add that that was one of the few things on that list that he actually did do, but his actions led to Judge Pede being recused from the case down the line. Andre Wright's behaviors would come back to haunt this case, but we'll get to that as we go along. Sometime in 2023, Thomas Rahn wanted to return to the DA's office, so Investigator Wright moved to the Bullock office. Some evidentiary motions were heard by Judge Pede in 2023, but as I mentioned in the last episode, orders were not entered before Judge Pede was recused in the fall of 2023. 2024 brought elections, and while Judge Hubie, who ran for Judge Pede's position unopposed as Judge Pede's basically anointed successor, Daphne Totten found herself in a contested DA's race. As you might imagine, the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit is a conservative stronghold. While the people who run against an incumbent DA are generally criminal defense attorneys, that conflict is not seen to be inconsistent. In this race, the attacks on Daphne focused on mainly three areas: overspending, conviction rates, particularly on sexual assaults in Bullock County, and perceived mismanagement of the Crocker case. D. Robert Busby accused Daphne of spending too much money on getting new prosecutors into the office and on keeping them. Some of these claims may have been fueled by a defense bar that had gotten used to the plead-dismiss-dead-docket cycle of the Mallard era. The judges had liked it, too, since they believed cases were moving. It was an illusion, of course. Remember those high caseload and backlog numbers? And there were still some serious cases in there that had gone untouched for years. Daphne had hired prosecutors to move the cases, but many of those prosecutors understood that the law had not always been followed in the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit. They filed motions, like motions to compel, you know, those ones I drafted in the Crocker case. They didn't just wing it, and they weren't okay with the case they had put work into being picked up by another prosecutor that had no knowledge of the case and then pleading it out or dismissing it because they happened to be present in court on a day the judge decided to talk about that specific case. Candidate Busby was quick to exploit the tension between the DA's office and the bench. I want to address some of these claims he was making. What was going on with the sexual assault cases would be anyone's guess. Bullock County is home to Georgia Southern University, and this was the hashtag MeToo era. The strength of the cases may not have withstood the rigors of trial, but no prosecutor in this period of time wanted a reputation for dismissing sexual assault allegations. The conviction numbers used by the Busby campaign were provably false, but Daphne had not done any politicking before she drew opposition, so she was unprepared for the attacks, and the falsity and personal nature of some of them evoked an emotional response from her that could not be summed up as a punchy three-word ad campaign. The Crocker attacks were, of course, wholly misplaced. The mismanagement had come from the bench. Even Investigator Wright's procedural error with the ex parte order was easily avoided. All Judge Pede had to do was tell Investigator Wright he couldn't sign the order, and that would have been the end of it. Not that Candidate Busby knew that or cared about it. What he knew was that the case had been pending for almost 6 years. It was the most serious case in the circuit, as he constantly proclaimed, and the case hadn't been tried. Candidate Busby vowed that he would try the case himself because a case like this is one that the elected DA should represent the people of the circuit in the courtroom. That turned out to be just so much political rhetoric after Mr. Busby won the election. So where did things go after that? We'll give you a break, but tune in next week.